In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, writer Nick Spencer joins us to talk about his Image books, like the current series Morning Glories, past books like Forgetless and Shuttertown, future books like Infinite Vacation, and a slew of mainstream stories. You've seen his work on Jimmy Olsen in Action Comics. Coming up later this month, you'll be seeing his debut with the Thunder Agents, and in January, Supergirl. Plus, later for Marvel, War Machine with Barry Kitson. We talk about all those and more in this edition of Word Balloon. Today, it's sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where you'll find a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, and more at great discounts. 38% off DC, Marvel, and Image books, and 42% off Dark Horse books. They're all waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. And there's a nice selection of Nick Spencer books available at InStockTrades.com. You can get a complete collection of Existence 2.0 and 3.0 from InStockTrades.com with great art from Ron Salas. The standard retail price is $14.99, but at InStockTrades.com, just $9.29. Or how about Shuttertown? You can get the hardcover for that. The standard retail price is $19.99, but at InStockTrades.com, $12.39. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. For all the details, check out their websites, Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com, InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. Well, you're coming up smelling roses, or whatever the hell it is. It seems like it, in a good way.
I'm coming up smelling like roses. Doesn't mean I'm dead or something.
No. That's Ethel Merman sang it right when she said everything is coming up roses. So no, you're doing good.
First Ethel Merman reference. I'm officially on Word Balloon.
This is true. You got to forgive me. I just saw Red, so Ernest Borgnine's Wives came to mind. Even that 1 month married to Ethel Merman, exactly. So, well, Nick, I'm sorry it's taken so long for you to come on. You've written some very interesting Image books, and I've been following Morning Glories, and am thrilled to have heard of all the convention announcements that happened before New York, and then the riches continue with after New York. You're Mr. Mainstream alongside all the Image stuff now. Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you, sir. Thanks.
Very neat. Now, you know, I'll be honest, I didn't get a chance to go to any of the panels, so... Jamal Igel is the man who told me that you were taking over Supergirl. So start there, and let's talk about that. Sterling, I think, and Jamal did a great job of after the book was kind of out of control for the first, year or so, they kind of pulled things together and gave her a nice continuity and foundation. What can you tell us about the plans for Supergirl at this point?
No, Sterling and Jamal have had a phenomenal run on the book, really, is the only way you can say it. I think I was a big fan of the Loeb version of the character, in those initial issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after Jeff left the character, she sort of wandered around for a bit. And, there was a little bit of a struggle to figure out where to take her next. And Sterling and Jamal really came on to the book at a difficult time. And, they pulled her away from what I loved about the Loeb issues and what I loved about the reinvention of the character was when you picked up those early issues of Supergirl, you knew that the entire DCU was going to be involved and that every issue was going to feel like it had like that $300 million budget. And, there were going to be a million guest stars in every issue. And, that was a lot of fun, but what Sterling and Jamal ended up doing was really taking the character and sort of pulling her back and really defining her, really fleshing her out as a person, really giving her own identity, her own sense of purpose. A lot of what we do really spins directly out of what those guys did on the book. My approach was, when they came to me and they said, do you want to work on Supergirl? I said, well, I like what these guys have done. I really think that they've done a really amazing job of growing the character up somewhat and really, taking Kara, to her own, in her own place. And I said, now I think it's time to bring her back into the DCU to an extent. And particularly, I wanted to do a story about Kara's place among the younger heroes of the DCU, because I think that that's something that still needs to be explored somewhat. Kara walked around with the biggest symbol in the DC universe on her chest every day, And it's only natural that that would have an impact on her peers, on the heroes that are her age and the way that they view her. And so this story is very much about, now that Kara has sort of figured out where she is as a person and she's sort of carved out her own life, now it's about her walking back into the room and reintroducing herself to a lot of people and saying, this is who I am now and this is where we should go forward from here.
Are you talking to guys like James Robinson, who's been using her in Justice League? Because obviously there's a little bit of that going on in the DC universe already. And no, I can kind of see that being an important step now to
definitely.
Say.
Definitely. I mean, what James is doing on the Justice League side, I think, again, it comes down to everybody on that team, or most of the people on that team, at least I should say, are at least a few years older than her. It's a younger Justice League, but it's still, you know, a class above her. You know, with guys like Dick and Donna, and So, what I really want to explore is where does Kara sit next to the heroes that are her age directly? Because with the Justice League, she still gets to be the young one, and she still gets to be an apprentice in some ways, and she still gets to be the kid. The situation that she's going to be thrown into here in the story that Bernard and I are doing. She can't be the kid anymore. In fact, you know, it's just the opposite. She's one of the older ones in the group. And as such, she's going to have to adjust to that. It's really a story about Kara trying to figure out how to be a leader.
Okay.
In a lot of ways. And, you know, I think she's got, obviously, the example of her cousin. And obviously, she's got the examples of Bruce and Diana as well, who had a big part in her life. But, you know, this is about her trying to figure out, is she going to be a leader? Is she going to be, you know, what Clark is to his generation of heroes? Is that her place? Is that her role? Because that's not really something that she's done yet. That's something that she's sort of shied away from at every step, and she's always, you know, in the background of whatever teams that she's a part of. And this story is very much about her trying to figure out, do I have what it takes to be a leader? So, yeah.
That's interesting because I really enjoyed when back in the Bronze Age when she would you know be with the when she was with the Legion of Superheroes, and
right.
and even though she was an active member, I never felt she was a leader. And I mean, she was a highly profiled featured player and had the relationship with Brainiac 5, you know. So she was definitely an important role player. But no, she never really seemed to be a leader, or even, you know, even as a point leader on a, you know, smaller sub team or something like that. So that's interesting.
It is just not something she's done a lot of in any of the iterations of the character, really, regardless of continuity. It's just not usually her role. But again, when you're wearing that S, you know, when you're the only other person, you know, when there's only two other people wearing that. You know, in a given fight, you know, let's say there's, you know, 20 heroes here fighting somebody, odds are somebody's going to look up and see her and say, that's the person in charge here, because that's the one wearing the S.
And sure.
That's what we do. And that's a big part of this story, is her realizing that, is her learning that, and her figuring out if that's what she wants to be, and if so, how will she do it? So it's very much a growth process for her of figuring out. Look, there have been a lot of stories about Kara figuring out her place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big things that struck me is normally at the end of those stories, all we really say is, well, she's going to be just like her cousin. She's going to wear the same thing. She's going to do the same stuff. And that's it. That's all there is to it. That doesn't strike me as something that a 17 or 18-year-old girl would do. You know, I don't think any of us want to just, I don't think any of us grow up just saying, I want to be just like the person before me. You know, Kara's trying to figure out different ways of doing things. That doesn't mean that she doesn't want a hero. That doesn't mean that she doesn't want to be like Clark. It just means she wants to figure out a new way to do certain things. And that, the big part of this story is her exploring that and figuring that out. And it's a lot of trial and error, and she's going to be up against somebody who is basically asking the same questions from the other side. You know, the villain that we're going to introduce in this arc, I can't say too much about who it is yet, but it's a new character that is very much asking the same questions from a more sinister side. And everybody, it's just a story about everybody trying to find their place in life at those ages and trying to figure out where they fit in with their peers. You know, it's a pretty universal story in that sense.
Sounds like a new legacy character will be entering the DC universe.
And legacy character, yeah, I think I can say that, yeah.
Okay, very interesting. Yeah. Cool, well, that's good. That's a good enough tease, and I think that makes things interesting. Is Superman fair game in your book, or is he still walking the country and he's not allowed to appear in Supergirl?
That's so classified, John. That's just so classified.
Is it true? Is it really?
You know, look,
that's hilarious.
He can fly, too. I just want to point out that Kara can go wherever she wants in the country.
I would think so.
If she needs to talk to Clark, flying out to Montana or wherever, not impossible.
Okay.
Not out of the question. and we'll leave it there.
All right.
You know, look, I'm not writing Supergirl so that I can not have, you know, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman pop in at some point. But,
very good.
You know, we'll see if that's able to happen here or not, and whether or not this particular story calls for it.
All right, man, no worries. And I understand it is her book. And then I think is the concern probably of our editors and writers, because anytime you have a Superman family character, a different character leading the book, you know, it's personally, I've always enjoyed it. And I was looking forward to what you were going to do with Jimmy Olsen. In the long term, because, you know, and I always felt this way about a Lois Lane book as well, in terms of I really think that it's Superman's cast of characters that are strong enough to be leads in their own books, even
Superman
today.
Superman has one of the best supporting casts of anybody in comics, there's no question, and I love playing around with everybody in Metropolis, and, you know, I've had a blast writing Jimmy, obviously. But, you know, even the pages, when I get to work on Lois and I get to write Perry and obviously introducing Chloe into the mix, it's been a blast for me. I really love that supporting cast. I think that those characters have so much history to them themselves, you know, that those characters are decades old themselves, and there's such a great tradition of strong work in terms of fleshing out those characters that they are an absolute blast to work on. But, yeah, it, for me, with Kara, what I would say is I am always very aware of the fact that she is not, in the modern continuity, she is not just Clark's cousin. You know, that Batman had an important role in her development as a hero, and Wonder Woman certainly did in training her. And as a result, she is almost really the product of all three of them. And that she has a very strong connection with all parts of the Trinity there, and that's something that really stands out to me with her is we have a lot of legacy heroes in the DCU, obviously, but what really makes Kara stand apart is all three of the biggest players in the DCU have had some hand in shaping who she is today, and that's an enormous part of the appeal of the character for me.
Are we going to find new heroes and heroines that will connect with Kara in a way we haven't seen before? As you say, you're going to have her where her role is with her peers. So does that afford the chance of new matchups that we haven't seen before with Supergirl?
Yeah, definitely. She's going to be interacting with a few characters for the first time, some characters that are still relatively new to the DC Universe. And that is, again, a part of the fun because, you know, Kara's changed a lot over the last couple of years. You know, however you want to measure time in the DCU, she is not the same character that she was when Jeff was writing her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's changed a lot over the course of that time. And so to some extent, she's really excited about dealing with people she's never met before. Because they don't maybe remember those things about her. You know, at the same time, she's excited to reunite with some of the people that she knew back then to show them how much she's changed. So there's just that process of, and I think anybody that remembers what it was like to be 16, 17, 18 knows what that's like, where you're just changing so dramatically every year. You know, I had friends when I was a kid, you know, that I only saw it during the summers, you know, that I only saw it during summer vacations. And I remember how you would change so much during the course of that school year, and then you would see them, and, you know, you had a completely different life than you had the year before. And Kara's very much like that. She's changed a lot, and she's eager to show it.
Interesting. Very cool. And so, and this starts in January? When does your run start?
January, yeah. Me and Bernard kick off things in issue 60.
Fantastic. And, Don, we mentioned Jimmy Olsen, and obviously this is post-New York Comic Con, so a lot of the co-features have found new platforms, or will continue to find new platforms. So what can you tell us about the future of what you've done with Jimmy Olsen so far?
Well, you know, the story is pretty untouched. It's just the method of delivery, which isn't nearly as big a deal. You know, the story hasn't changed one iota as a result of all the publishing plans and all that kind of stuff. And I was excited about, you know, obviously I think that DC, you know, just had a great PR win and made a really good decision in the whole 299, 20 pages across the board
thing. I agree.
So I was, you know, I was as happy as anybody else that that news affects my wallet just like it affects everybody else's. And, you know, I think that they made a terrific decision there. And, you know, so for my part, I completely, you know, understood it and was excited about it. And, you know, from there, figuring out what to do with Jimmy was pretty simple. And nothing is entirely concrete there just yet. We're still figuring out things about, you know, what's the next steps with him. I mean, everybody at DC has been amazingly supportive of that story, and it seems to have really struck a chord with a lot of people. And I personally have a lot of fun writing it. For me, when I was a kid, I had stacks and stacks of Jimmy Olsen back issues that my parents would buy me at back issue bins. So for me to be working on Jimmy Olsen is a thrill, and I'm excited to hear people just talking about the character again and liking the character and having fun with him. And this stuff has a way of sorting itself out if people are responding to the stories and having fun with them. So I don't think by any means you've seen the last of this sort of new vision of Jimmy and this new story, and I hope that it'll stick for a while.
Good deal. Well, no, it sounds like you had a lot of interesting ideas that you talked about at the San Diego panel, and certainly we got a taste of it in the most recent issue of Action. So
finally, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, one of the strangest things to get used to in terms of the Marvel and DC work is how far ahead you are of things actually coming up. Because at Image, man, you know, if you can get the book done a week before it's supposed to be out, that's like some kind of miracle.
I understand.
So to have people have finally seen it after months and months of working on it, it was a dream come true. It was real exciting, and that to have your first big two work be in Action Comics. I don't care if it's a co-feature or not. It's just, come on. What can you really say about that? It was so cool to pick up an issue of Action Comics with my name on it. That was nuts. And so for me to be writing a character that I loved so much as a kid and who I'd always wanted to do something with, to have that opportunity sort of fall into my lap and have that be the first thing that I do, because you always assume that the first couple things you do, you never say this publicly, but, you know, maybe it wouldn't be exactly what you would pick if they gave you carte blanche to pick whatever you wanted. So to have DC come to me and say, you know, do you want to work on Jimmy Olsen, without even knowing how excited I would be about that prospect, it was just a lot of good things coming together at once. I got pretty lucky there.
Very cool, man. And I'm a longtime Jimmy Olsen fan as well. I'm sure I've mentioned it before on other podcasts. My friend Tom Caters from Around Comics was a big Superman family reader, as I am as well. And the years of Mr.
God bless you, Tom Caters.
See?
God bless you, Chris Sims. And I knew I knew that I was doing okay the day that it came out on Comixology. It came out digitally before
yes.
it came out in print.
Yes, yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I loved it. We were ecstatic about it. It seemed like the perfect perfect book, perfect story to do that with. Because obviously, look, most people are picking up Action Comics for Paul Cornell and the Luther story, and they should be because it's amazing. So we had this nice opportunity with this little story that we could give it away for free. And obviously a lot of people read things when they're free. And so it's great for me, you know, to have my first work get read by a lot more people by virtue of not charging for it. And but I knew, like, that night, I think it went up on Comixology at 11 o'clock at night. And, yeah, Chris Sims and Tom Caters and Dean Tripp, who are, you know, sort of the guardians of Jimmy's virtue on the internet, they were all immediately on the Twitter saying that they approved, saying that the story passed muster.
Absolutely, man, and that's why I was looking forward to it, too. It's
never let it be said that bloggers do not have power with insecure writers. Never let that be said.
Very nice. No, I'm glad to hear that, and I will agree with my Redheaded League friends and say as well that, yeah, and I think James showed that, too, when in the specials that he did. Jimmy's a fun character, and he could be a goofy character, but I also think I like it, and I'm thinking it was James that said it, that the deal with Jimmy is one day in the future, and it's a day we'll never see, he's going to be, like, the best reporter that the planet ever had.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Was it you? And, did you say that in a panel, or did James say that?
No, that's a James thing. Yeah, that's but he's 110% right about that. You know, that Jimmy is – I always – and I'm not getting too much of an opportunity in this first story to play with it beyond a couple of pages, but I am enormously fascinated with the relationship between Jimmy and Lois, especially because I think that Jimmy idolizes Lois in a way that is beyond even the way that he idolizes Superman. That I think for Jimmy, you know, Lois is everything that he really aspires to be. Jimmy thinks that being Superman would be kind of fun and be kind of cool, but what Jimmy really wants to be is Lois. He
Sure.
really wants to be the best reporter in Metropolis, and he really wants to be the best reporter in the world. Yeah, I think that Jimmy's on that path, you know, and it's exactly right. It's one of those stories that you never really get to see, but one of the tricks, I think, with Jimmy as a character is it's so easy to just reduce him to a sidekick and just sort of reduce him to a buffoon.
Right.
And, you know, that's just not who he is. You know, that there's a reason why he gets to be in that room, that there are reasons why Superman sticks so close to him. And, you know, why Lois and Perry, you know, involve him so much.
Yep.
There are reasons for that. Jimmy has enormous potential and enormous ability. And he has a sort of fearlessness and a sort of energy that's contagious to the people around him. And that's just a huge part of who he is as a character. So yeah, that's absolutely right. He certainly will be that. He has it in him. He has a lot in him. That's really what's fun about the character is he has no superpowers most of the time. If he does, they're very temporary and they're only going to cause crazy hijinks. But, you know, when you get past that, he is just somebody who is so determined to live his life to the absolute fullest. And he just has this thing that no matter what situation he's in, he's going for it. Yeah, he's just kind of taking life by the balls. And that is what's fun for me is how you can just write these stories where he doesn't need to have any crazy technology or any superpowers or anything. And people can still get excited about that journey, because that enthusiasm that he has, that energy that he has, it's contagious.
No, I understand, man, and I think it was something that we saw in the Jimmy Olsen feature when it went to the Superman family, because at that point he kind of was allowed to be a bit more of an adult in the same way that Dick Grayson was,
right.
And that he
right.
was kind of – he wasn't the teen photographer anymore. He was in his early 20s, and yeah, I mean, was in – you know, again, we laugh about it now, Mr. Action. That was his that was his name, and, you know, in his columns and
yeah,
stuff, because
yeah.
he was finally being allowed to be a reporter and was very resourceful, as you say, didn't need the powers, didn't need the technology, could rely on his own abilities and stuff. And, you know, really, if anything, Superman, when he did show up, was there for cleanup. And basically, it was, yeah, that's okay, pal. I got it. You got it covered. Don't worry.
Absolutely. If you're writing some story where Jimmy did nothing and, you know, he's just screwed up and Superman has to come in and save him, you just wrote a Jimmy Olsen story wrong. I've read pretty much all of them, and I can tell you that's not how it works. You know, Jimmy is Jimmy creates his own situations, which is not to say that he doesn't need Superman from time to time, but he's not just somebody there to get kidnapped. He
Right. He
definitely controls his own destiny.
That's excellent, and great fun that they've finally figured out a way to bring Chloe Sullivan into continuity.
Yeah.
So
yeah. That is something that I think I'm always going to be really proud of. I hope that a lot of other writers, you know, pick that up and run with it. I would love nothing more than to see. I know I'm going to be real excited the first day that I see somebody else write Chloe in a comic. You know, because it was a real thrill for me to get to introduce a new character like that, and somebody that I felt like had good potential to be around the DCU and around Metropolis for a long time. So to make those Smallville fans happy, you know, that show has an enormously dedicated fan base.
Sure.
And to get some of them excited about picking up a comic, that was a blast for me, to really see that response from them. And then, you know, I was terrified of what they would think of it. And by and large, you know, they all seem to really enjoy it, and I think that'll only get better because she gets more time as the story goes on, and she gets to be herself a little bit more, I think, as the story moves forward. And that was a blast for me to introduce a character like that. I was a big fan of, you know, especially the early seasons of the show, and it felt really right. It felt like the right time to bring her in, the right place to bring her in, and thankfully everybody at DC was really, really excited about the idea and worked really hard to make it happen, and sure enough it did.
Now, how many pages is this story arc that you were able to do with Jimmy?
It was originally conceived as a 7-part story, all 10 pages.
Okay.
So it's
okay.
Like a 70-pager overall, but then there's more coming, we think.
Okay.
It's not firmed up, but I certainly want to do more, and I'm asking to do a little more. One of the big things is, as you can tell from the first chapter of the action story, we really just dropped Chloe in and sort of picked up midway through her story with Jimmy. And I'd like to go back. One of my big goals is to go back and explain her origins a little bit more, explain her ties to Smallville, explain her ties to Superman, and all those things, because there is a plan there.
Okay.
There is a story there, and, you know, for all the people who are like, well, she's still kind of Chloe, but she doesn't seem to know this, or she doesn't seem to have this certain connection.
Yeah, she can't be the same character she was in Smallville, obviously.
Exactly, but I worked very hard to come up with a plan that protected as many of those things that make Chloe Chloe as humanly possible, and it is there. You just haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
So, hopefully we can get back to it and explore a little bit about how she came to Metropolis, her own origins, and how she met Jimmy and all that stuff.
Well, good. You know, I can't help but notice, especially this week, so many 80-page giants and 100-page spectaculars mm-hmm. that
right.
DC continues to flirt with. So, and certainly there is the digital market as well. So,
Absolutely. So
hopefully, yeah, we will, you know, there will be something satisfying that will allow.
It'll get out there. It's not, the story's not going to be, you know,
inventoried.
Yeah. It's everybody at DC has been so amazingly supportive of this story. And, it's not one of these things where they just want to get it done with. They really want to protect this story and make sure that as many people read it as possible. So, it's not something that I'm worried about. We haven't quite figured out all the plans yet, but everybody's working hard on it, so it'll be fine.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about another DC project that was mentioned over the summer,
yeah.
Thunder Agents.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a big fan of those characters, and I got a George Tuska portfolio of the Thunder Agents back that was done, I want to say, in the 80s. Yeah. And I even enjoyed the few iterations we saw in the 80s here and there from the various people,
right.
Including Penthouse Comics, I remember.
Right.
I remember that well.
Oh, John, what a memory you have for the smut.
Exactly, man. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just getting it for the articles, I assure you.
Right.
But the – no, it was – I was a big – it was. They were interesting characters. And really, I think it was Alter Ego Magazine or Comic Book Artists, I forget which, did a wonderful – you know, history of the Tower comics and Wally Wood's, you know, creation of these characters and everything. So these are neat characters. Now, we just saw, you know, the wrap-up of the Red Circle characters, you know, with DC. And I imagine there are some lessons to be learned in terms of the, you know, the I think the buying public, the willingness to invest in a new group of heroes. And I wonder, you know, this has to be rattling through your guys' heads as well as you plan this series.
It does and it doesn't, you know, because at some point you have to just sit down and say, well, I'm going to write the best story I can, and I'm going to hope that it resonates with as many people as possible. And you really can't worry too much about the market stuff.
Okay.
All the time. So I don't. I think that we've got a really special story here, something that's very different from anything on the shelves. We worked very hard to come up with a unique voice for this book. I looked at a lot of the other, you know, attempted relaunches of long lost characters like this, and one of the first things that I said was, the big problem that a lot have is sort of what differentiates this set of characters, other than the fact that you haven't seen them from 30 years, from the characters that you have been seeing for the last 30 years. And I tried to tap into sort of the brilliance of that original Tower run. You know, Wally Wood was so far ahead of his time in terms of those character concepts. And some of the things that he brought in there are so nuanced and so dark in comparison to even in the Silver Age, when, you know, fleshing out characters is really starting to take hold, he was still doing something miles past that. And I wanted to try to do the same. I wanted to say, okay, what do I think that superhero comic books are going to look like in 20, 30 years? And really try to approach this with fresh eyes and try to make it a very different take and try to make it a very unique story. I think that what we decided to do here was, obviously, it's a tough climate to launch this kind of story or this kind of book or to launch these kinds of characters again. So we just sat down and said, let's go nuts. Let's take a bunch of chances. And let's really play jazz with it, and we have nothing to lose here. And so I'm enormously proud of the end result. I've seen the first issue now, and you just hope that you can do certain things that leave a little bit of a mark and that maybe people take notice of and say, wow, that is a very different way of looking at things. And I really believe that this book could be that. I tend to be very naive about these things, and I could have written this so that, you know, we had Batman guest starring in issue 2 and we tied into some big events in issue 3 and things like that. We could have just gone a very crass route and just threw as many, you know, marketing ploys at it as we possibly could. And what we ended up coming back with and saying was, let's just throw out the playbook and try to do something new here. I'm excited to see people's response. Of all the things that I'm working on, it's the one that I'm most curious to hear what people think of. Because I do think that a lot of people are going to be talking about it.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm a big fan of all those characters. Dynamo's awesome, and Nomad, and I've enjoyed their stories, and got even the actual real Thunder Agents of Weed and the intelligence support group is under Sea Agent going to be in there?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, at some point. And,
fantastic.
It was such a brilliant concept, the way that he tied so many of these characters into their own downfalls.
Yes.
And that's really a big part of what this story expounds upon. is the trade-offs that were involved in all these different characters' powers and abilities. And then taking that even further and just looking at the characters themselves and just saying that as they do these things, there are prices to be paid for these things. And we've taken it in a pretty brave direction here. So, we'll see if everybody likes it.
That's excellent, man. Now, if for people who haven't read the original stories and stuff, it's worth looking up their histories, and I'll let Nick tell his story, and I won't go into detail either, but I can imagine some of the directions. And it's in the same way that I've always wanted people to revisit Golden Age characters with today's writing sensibilities, because there were great ideas that weren't really given the opportunity to be explored because they were written for a 10-year-old and 12-year-old audience back then.
Sure.
And yeah, there's some really dark stuff that happens with the Thunder Agents. And yeah, again, if you really chose to, you know, treat it as a mature title, it would be an interesting exploration of how these characters are able to exist and, as you say, the price they pay for the choices they make.
There's just so much nuance to the story, really, one of the things that I always come back to is immediately in the first arcs you're dealing with this threat of the subterraneans in the tower comics run, and they talk about how the subterraneans are angry because we've been doing bomb testings underground that have destroyed their cities.
Right.
And the amazing thing is, for Silver Age book, nobody ever disputes this. Nobody ever says that we didn't do it, and that, to see that in a Silver Age book like that, to just sort of say, well, yeah, we probably did, and it's probably horrible. It just struck me when I was reading it, just how brave that was to put that kind of thing in, and to sneak it in such a way that it didn't anger the masses, but it's still there, and you can still see it.
No, you're right. This was
that refusal to let things drop into like black and white terms, and it really did amaze me going through the original run and seeing so much of that stuff, especially in those first few issues. I mean, those first few issues, what Lynn Brown and Wally Witt are doing, it's really incredible stuff. And I mean, I figure if nothing else, starting this run will probably inspire a few people to go pick up the archive versions.
Very cool.
To go pick up the hardcovers. And if nothing else, I love that more people are going to go grab those, because really, there's a lot of brilliant work in there.
No, I agree with you, man. And this was a couple of years before Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams were getting relevant with comics. And,
right.
Even the Spider-Man drug comics and things like
right,
that.
Right.
So, yeah, no, it's and also, yeah, this good combination of social relevance, superheroes, espionage. A lot was going on in a very small, was it 2-year burst, basically, of
right.
Thunder Agents. I mean,
yeah.
I know Dynamo went to about 25, if I remember right. So
yeah,
pretty neat.
Yeah,
man.
You look back on those original books. You know, they were even brave about the format. You know, they had these great oversized issues and everything like that. And
for a quarter,
exactly. Don't say that. Don't get all too nostalgic, John.
Man, a quarter. No, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Man. Too funny. I grabbed. I was able to find an issue of Dynamo at the Wizard Chicago show. I was thrilled. It's my first. It's my first original issue. I've read reprints and read the alter ego history of the Thunder Agents, but it was really neat to actually pick up a couple issues and really see them firsthand. It was neat.
Yeah, well, and the other thing that I would say about it is all of that tower run is in continuity to this story. We involve all of it, and it plays a major role in what happens. I didn't want to just come in and reinvent everything and throw that stuff out. All of that stuff is a big part of where the story is headed from here.
So it's a continuation then of what we've seen.
It is
very cool.
All that stuff is in there. All that stuff happened. Speaking of the original Tower Comics run, that stuff is all canon to this.
That's terrific. Well, and I know a lot of artists and writers were big fans as well and couldn't wait to get the opportunity to write them when the opportunities came in the 80s, and things were kind of murky about whether the characters were in public domain.
Right.
A couple smaller publishers were able to come back, and you saw guys like Dave Cochran drawing the book and, really good writers and really good artists doing it. Kevin McGuire, I want to say, did some of the Penthouse Comics stuff, if I remember right. So, yeah, right. Really neat stuff, man. This is great. And
the original run is all in there.
Very good.
We really wanted to honor that.
That's terrific. So when does that begin?
That kicks off in November.
Fantastic. Oh, it's coming up next month. Fantastic.
The art is amazing. It's a guy named Kafu. He's done some Superman stuff. He did the Vixen stuff with G. Willow Wilson.
Very good.
He's been sort of circling, and this is going to be the book, I think, where everybody just notices this guy in a big way, because really the pages that he's turning in are amazing. I mean, DC has a real find on their hands with this guy.
And is this hopefully an ongoing, or is this a miniseries? What's going on with this?
It's ongoing.
Excellent, man.
Yeah.
Well, very cool.
So, no, we got a long plan on it, so hopefully we'll get to tell the whole story.
Outstanding. Well, this is great. Very excited about that. Now let's talk about the current book that you've got from Image, Morning Glories. Issue 3 is hovering, and you were kind enough to give me a sneak peek and everything. So this is a teen academy, and we're learning mysteries about the academy and both the instructors and the people that are there. But it's a very interesting dark book with tinges of horror, tinges of science fiction. There seems to be a kind of Da Vinci Code kind of mystery that seems to be unraveling as well. All of this, very, as you said in your high concept one sentence pitch, it's Lost meets Runaways.
Right.
So right.
I think that one tagline sold about 5K. So I think I owe a good deal to that one little second of inspiration there.
Well, clearly, the book keeps selling out. Congratulations! This is wonderful success, man.
No, it's amazing. I've never had the response. I've never had a book get a response like this. So it's been just sort of stupefying to sit back and see the numbers and see the thing constantly going back to press. And, you know, I know that a lot of people get skeptical about this stuff. Like, you know, I know that I did when I would see this kind of news and everything. All I can say is the print runs are pretty healthy, you know, like for an Image book, actually, they're being pretty generous on the reprint numbers, and the thing just keeps burning through them, you know, which is really just a testament. I mean, people have been so amazing about this book in terms of word of mouth. I've never really seen a book get this kind of evangelism from its readers. They just seem to just be dedicated to exposing it to more people and sharing it with their friends. And it's been incredible to watch. I couldn't be more proud. We couldn't be more excited. The whole team just sits back and can't believe where this thing is going.
Well, and I think you're fortunate that timing is everything, and it seems like you beat a similar concept that's coming to television. Am I right for ABC Family? Am I right about that?
Take that, Paul Dini.
You know what it makes? And we all love Paul Dini. Don't get me wrong, but
of course,
it reminds me of 10 years ago when Bendis came out with Alias. And within 6 months, we had a television show called Alias that was different enough, but in a lot of ways, there was a shared resemblance. And for the comic book fans, you know, Brian was there first, and so the book was accepted, and, you know, it took off.
Right.
And I kind of see a similar thing happening here because, you know, again, I think it's a good concept. It's the setting makes sense, and I think it fits that audience. Go ahead. You talk about it now.
It's pretty surreal. It's pretty surreal to have the same ideas in certain ways as Paul Dini. Like, that alone says, okay, you're maybe on the right track.
Sure.
I never get bothered by that kind of thing because it's just, you know, if you can be lucky enough to have even, you know, a tenth of the same idea as a guy like that, you're doing good.
You bet, man. Absolutely.
You know, and I've seen the first episode of Tower Prep, and it's really good. I definitely recommend that people watch it. It's a fun show, but it's very different from what we're doing in terms of tone and in terms of the characters, and probably almost certainly in terms of where it's going to go from there. But the initial settings are a little similar. I think that just speaks to how universal some of that stuff is. I think that people like stories about... Look, we all hated our teachers, or at least some of them, you know? Who didn't want to, you know, I mean, not to get all Columbine about it, I just mean, you know, like,
no, I know what you
every
mean.
Once in a while everybody wanted to blow up a classroom. I mean,
no,
so...
Maybe not that extreme, but certainly,
Right. Well, maybe that was just me. But,
there's a reason why kids get acne during high school. There's a lot of stress going on. I mean, that's all right. It's not just puberty.
Right. I mean, what? It's a little...
A lot of pressure.
It's a little fun. It's a little chemical high explosive. It's just for fun. It's just for laughs.
No problem.
No, I think that there are universal themes of sort of struggling against authority and, trying to find your own place in the world and trying to break free that... You know, just everybody remembers what those feelings were like. And I think, what both those stories in a lot of ways are really, those stories are really all about that. And that's why they resonate. And that's why you see writers constantly go back to those settings. Because they're just great places to tell those stories.
And we've gone through three issues, or we're about to hit the third issue. There's a thing with stories like Lost and Heroes and stories where there's a big mystery, and you've got to set that right tone of giving people enough information to keep them wanting to come back for the next issue, but also keeping the mystery, you know, stringing it out long enough too that you're able to tell the story in the pace that you want it to. How's that balancing act for
writing? Sure. I mean, we want to milk this thing, you know. I mean, like, we want to just bleed it dry.
It's a 20-year plan.
We're taking the needle like all the way down to E on this thing. You know, like, this book is around until the diamond cutoff like isn't met. You know, so...
Do you have a set,
No, I know when the book is ending, I know where the book is ending, I know how the book is ending. That was real important to me. I just could never put something out without knowing where it was going. It would terrify me, and it would be more stress than it would be worth. There's a plan in place. It's a long-term plan. I think that the book is going to be around for, we either say like 75 or 100 issues is the goal. Now, you know, whether or not we get to take that long with it is going to depend greatly on the level of interest that's sustained and everything. But based on, obviously, the early reaction, we feel like we can start to think long-term and plan for a long and healthy future. But in terms of that question of what do you give them and when, what I would say is, honestly, it comes down to the characters to a large extent, that if people are interested in the characters and interested in their personal struggles, you can tell a mystery for a very long time. And if they're not, then, you know, you're going to need to start throwing out answers real fast. For me, this story has always been about the characters first. It's always been about the cast first. And so I'm not too worried about that aspect of things. We're going to do the old formula, you know. It's we're going to answer questions at the same time that we ask new ones. And it's going to take a long time to get to that point of closure on it. But the one promise that I do make to everybody that picks the book up is I really do. I know where this thing ends. I know what the last issue looks like pretty much in its entirety. There's nothing that we're making up as we're going along, and I can swear that I think that this will have a very fulfilling payoff. That was a big goal for me, was to be able to tell that kind of long-form mystery but not leave it with a sort of vague resolution or anything that anybody could question and say, well, you know, they probably figured that out around the midway point. So what I would say is that there are things in the first issue, there are things on the first page of the first issue that will tell people when the final issue drops, oh, there was a plan. They did know what they were doing. So That was a very important piece of the puzzle for me.
And how do you come up with this kind of epic story? I mean, like, do you know enough other writers that, you know, have written similar things? Have you had a chance to talk to Kirkman about something like that, or an Azzarello, or Jason Aaron, or Brian K. Vaughan, or somebody?
Yeah, I do get to talk to Kirkman a little bit about this kind of stuff, but really what it comes down to is, at the end of the day, you do have to trust yourself to a large extent. On Morning Glories, it was a very surreal experience where I remember I was staying with my family when I wrote the first issue, and the first issue is like 44 pages, mm-hmm. and I wrote the whole thing in a night, and not only did the whole script come out in a night, but I knew everything about where the book was going. Like, I knew the high concept, and I knew the plot points. Now, you know, a lot gets fleshed out in between there, and you still try to leave yourself some room to move and change things as you go along so that it doesn't start to feel like just monotony or routine to you.
Sure.
But the experience with Morning Glories was as close to a sort of, you know, Grant Morrisonian, you know, like, outside of my body, you know, talking to aliens experience, really, because it was an overnight thing. It was literally just the light bulb turned and I had it. And I've never really had that before or since. You know, I can remember writing that first issue and just not being able to type fast enough. And it was an amazing thing. And I had a feeling then, you know, that it was a book that would resonate. And this was before I had anything published. This was well before Existence 2.0 had even come out. And so, you know, I'm literally sitting in my parents' like log cabin in Kentucky. And, you know, I got no work to my name, and I'm like, this is going to be huge. So it's nice, you know, that a couple of years later, it could all sort of actually play out that way. That was a pretty fulfilling thing.
Now, I got my usual update from Bleeding Cool today of different stories, and I noticed in the second group of stories, and I missed it when he had posted about it, but he mentioned your political career.
Cincinnati. Yeah.
Well, yeah. How did you, and you know, I don't need full details, but I am curious what led you to writing, and I mean, what led you specifically even to writing comic books? Where'd you come from?
I got led away from writing to a certain extent. Back in college, what I wanted to do was write comic books.
Okay.
And
where'd you go to school?
I went to Xavier in Cincinnati.
Sure.
And good basketball team, good muscle.
Absolutely. I know Xavier, absolutely.
Yeah, of course. We're a scrappy little school. I was going to conventions, actually. I grew up in the same hometown as David Mack, and I would see David all the time. My girlfriend at the time worked at Kinko's that David would always go into and get prints made and copy stuff and things like that. And,
cool.
He would come in like on the late night shift, and I would you know, like, I told him this just recently, like last year, but my girlfriend at the time, we lived together, and we literally decorated our apartment in Kabuki scraps.
Wow.
In like bad prints that he threw out. Like, we would just frame them up, and that decorated the entire apartment. But so I would watch David and watch Brian, really, at shows. And, you know, I was like, that's what I want to do. And interestingly enough, I went to the Wizard World Chicago one year. This is probably, I guess, 11 years ago, something like that. And I got a chance to sit down with Bob Schreck, the amazing editor from, you know, Dark Horse and DC and Oni and
currently IDW, absolutely.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And Bob took me aside, did the kindest thing. I didn't realize at the time, when you're 19, you just think the entire world does this for you all the time. You know, you just think that, of course, everybody treats you special because you're special. But Bob took me, like, away from the convention floor and, like, just, you know, gave me, you know, like, some of the best advice I ever got in my life for, like, you know, 20 minutes. And basically it all boiled down to, he said, you know, I was writing this kind of horrible, like, hackneyed, Kevin Smith-ish, you know, guy who gets dumped by his girlfriend stories all the time. And he looked at it, and he looked over about two paragraphs of it, and he said, look, here's the good news. The good news is you're writing what you know, and that's very important, and that's good for a writer to do. And so the problem is you do not know shit. And, you know, and he talked a little about like Matt Wagner's life before he wrote Mage, and you know, and just about the various different experiences that writers had had in life, the lives that they lived before they came and sat down in front of a keyboard. And so, you know, he said, get out, take a few years from this, go do some things, travel, try different experiences and all these things. And so I did, you know, because there was something in the back of my head that was saying, you're not ready either. And so I went and did a few other things. I worked in politics for a bit and then, ran for local office myself, lost horribly, then went and started my own business and ran that horribly. And you know, all these things fail miserably, but the nice thing about it is that you get those experiences and you learn from them, and you just sort of, you know, gather those life stories and you just, you know, I would say this to anybody that came up to me now and they were, you know, in their late teens or early 20s and they want to know how to be a good writer. I would give them the exact same advice that Bob gave me. Because then when you sit down, you know, you bring so much more to the table. I mean, you look at Existence 2.0, for instance, you know, which was my first book with Image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a business fail miserably and I moved up to New York and I was, you know, diving into writing comics, and I was, you know, chasing this new life, and I completely lost touch with everybody back home. And Existence 2.0, if you look at the story is about a guy who gets a new life, and he thinks that it's everything that he wants, but at the end of the day, he recognizes that the people that he loved in his past life are a very important part of who he is. And I couldn't write that story without that experience.
Understood.
That story just wouldn't have come. So, you know, I think I've learned, you know, I'm at least an old enough age that I can recognize that, you know, our failures are a big part of what makes us who we are, you know, that our mistakes educate us and inform us in a lot of ways. And, you know, so I don't regret any of it. I you know, it's easy to sit there sometimes and think now, wow, I could have been doing this 10 years ago, but I couldn't have. So it's all part of the process, man.
No, I hear you, and I think that's a very telling answer, and I think that's great, and I'm glad that you've obviously learned that kind of lesson, because you don't, you know, I mean, sometimes it takes until you're in your 30s or 40s and realize that, you know, the thoughts that you had in your 20s really were the thoughts of immaturity, and that you need to live life before you really do have perspective. And
what the fuck does anybody know at 21?
You know, hey man, you know,
and
honestly, and it's okay because all of us, we all go through that. We all come out of college with all the answers, and are very happy to
tell
very happy to tell an older adult exactly what they should be doing with their lives. And it's great.
Yeah, and I will say that this is I will say that. Thematically, this is probably one of the bigger tip-offs of Morning Glories that I've ever given, really. But, you know, I would say that's a big part of that story, is that feeling that you just know everything at those ages, and that you know, you're the brilliant one that's going to change everything, and why that's right and wrong.
Sure.
And so, you know, because you need to have that part of life. You know, you need to have those very idealistic years, and you need to have that arrogance and...
it pushes you forward. It makes the ramen noodles go down a lot easier. or you know, or you face that weekend when you've got $9 until pay, you know,
right.
And you might be paid
right.
on Monday, or you might not.
Right.
And how are you going to make that stretch? No, man, we've all been there.
Right.
We have all been there, and that's why I sympathize with people coming out of college in this economy, and saying, God, what are we going to do? But then you know something, you know, honestly. For me, it was, you know, the mid 80s when I came out of school,
right.
And it was no easier. It really wasn't. And,
right, right.
And we all had to work at the ice cream store, or we all had to take
right.
three part-time
right.
jobs to make ends meet along with our regular job.
When you want things, when you want to do things, when you're serious about doing them, you know, you'll make it happen.
Exactly.
That's how it is. Look,
absolutely,
when I came up to New York, I moved up to New York. I had less than $100 in my pocket, you know, I was pretty much at the end of my rope, and I had a friend that said you can crash in my guest room for a week, you know, and I had not, and you just say, look, I got to make it happen. I remember the last New York con before this one, had nothing published to my name or anything, no pitches accepted, and I can remember talking to an editor at DC who was willing to look at something that I'd done with an artist, and I had $10. I remember I had $10, and that needed to last me like a week. And I remember she was willing to look at it, so I ran down to the Javits Kinko's and printed the stuff up again, and gave it to her, and then, you know, literally handed it to her and realized, okay, how are we going to eat this week? And that's okay, because that's what you got to do. And it's a thing where you have to be willing to take those chances. You listen to guys like Brian Bendis talk about the years that they had to work at this and, you know, work for free and lose money and, you know, just sacrifice so much to get where they are. And, you know, I'm very lucky. I didn't have to do it that long. You know, it happened relatively fast for me. The development curve has changed in certain ways, and you can move up a little quicker. But, you know, that's what the guys who are serious do. You know, they don't worry about how it affects other things, or they don't worry about what's standing in their way. They just make it happen.
No, I agree with you. Absolutely, man. And, yeah, like I said, I think there are a lot of other success stories that start the same way and have those kinds of struggles and everything. But as you say, you persevere, and, you know, the will has to be there, and you will find a way to make it happen if you stay with it. And opportunity, you know, they say luck is when opportunity meets preparation. And preparation is kind of during the struggle when, you know, you're kind of working in that vacuum and waiting for that moment to come. So
yeah, and then when it does, I mean, the challenge for you after that is, you know, I used to sit down and be like, when I would get a rejection, you know, when I would get a pitch rejected, you know, I would sit down and just say, okay, I got to prove everybody wrong here, you know, like the whole world seems to think I can't do this. The trick once you are is you got to find ways to tap back into that, you know, and find ways to push yourself in those same directions.
Definitely.
You know? So it never gets easier. You know, it's just a different mindset, and it's just a different situation. But it doesn't necessarily get easier per se.
Now you've had the two stories in existence. You did Shuttertown.
Right.
You're doing Morning Glories. Are there more original ideas that are sitting on the back burner?
Oh, sure. I mean, we just announced at NYCC. We just announced The Infinite Vacation with Christian Ward, who I think Christian is. A special talent that he did a book called Olympus for Image last year that a lot of people took note of the art there. But, you know, he's grown a lot since then, and his style is just amazing. And I really think that he's somebody that a lot of people are going to get real excited about here over the next year or two. It's a fun, high-concept story about a world where traveling between alternate realities has sort of become a common, everyday commercial endeavor, and you use it just routinely, or you use it for vacation, or you use it for work, wherever, and it's about a guy who's very addicted to that process, very addicted to the infinite vacation, and some things happen that cause him to start to question the way that he's living his life. You know, it's a love story. It's really a book that I'm excited to get out there. That one drops in January.
Cool.
And then, yeah, all through next year. I mean, I've got plans for a lot of creator-owned stuff. I'm real passionate that I'm so excited about working at Marvel and DC. But for me, you know, my creator-owned work will always have a real special place in my heart. And it's something that I never want to lose sight of, and that I want to make sure that I'm doing something, you know, one or two books at least every month on the creator-owned side.
Well, this is great. You know, it reminds me of John Hickman just a short while ago that, you know, again, yeah, that he's able to kind of release his stuff and go hand-in-hand creator-owned stuff along with some mainstream stuff. So this is...
That's my guy. He's you know, he's just one of the best friends that have gotten in the industry, and I always go to him for advice, and he's just... he's just one of the nicest, best people you'll ever meet.
I agree. Well, I'm a big fan as well, and both personally and talent-wise. So, yeah, that's good. You're in good company, man. Very cool. Now, we mentioned Marvel, and we should talk about is it being called Iron Man 2.0, or is it being called...
It is Iron Man 2.0, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
but
yeah,
it is the...
book is Iron Man 2.0.
And it's the adventures, the continuing adventures of James Rhodes, and... You know, so the former War Machine, and you know, I can see from a branding standpoint that might actually help the book right off the bat, frankly.
Sure.
I mean, people certainly
from a commercial
Marvel
standpoint.
Yeah, Marvel people certainly know who Rhodey is, and now you know, Iron Man film fans, you know, obviously are getting a good education of the background of War Machine and everything. So I've been reading your interviews post announcement. What would you like to tell us about the series?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's. I get why, you know, people say they look at that title and they say, oh, you know, it's Iron Man 2.0. That's a nice idea in terms of sales. And it is. But it's also a big part of the story. You know, this story is very much an indictment of the way that Rhodey's been doing things previously. Not just Rhodey, but the military that Rhodey often comes to represent a lot of the time. But it's a story about the changing face of warfare, and it's a story about the way that we're fighting very differently than we used to. And one of the first things that I was struck by when it came to the character was, you know, you see him and he's got these big guns and missiles and bombs and, you know, he's a very imposing figure. He's, you know, it just looks like an armored tank. And the first thing that I really thought was, if you dropped this down into Afghanistan tomorrow, it would not necessarily change the situation in Afghanistan a great deal. We have nuclear bombs, you know, like we have things that you can drop from the sky that obliterate miles and miles of surface. You know, that is just not what's needed anymore. So if a bad guy wants to show up and fight Rhodey head on in that War Machine armor, great, you know, they're probably going to lose. The trick is that there are a lot of enemies that governments face now that don't look like that. They just don't confront you head on. They just don't agree to meet at a certain place at a predetermined time and
right.
fight. And this is a story about Jim coming up against something like that. And it's about him trying to figure out how to adapt to that and how to evolve. And if he doesn't, he's in serious trouble. You know, this is very much a book about, you know, evolving or dying. And he's dealing with something that very much is the face of asymmetrical warfare that is, in its own way, a sort of war machine. And he's going to have to change things up. And he's in a very difficult situation while he's trying to figure out how to do it. He's got a lot of pressures from a lot of different sides. He's sort of balancing himself between Stark and the military. And, you know, it's a situation that he's been in before. But normally when Rhodey is in that situation, he's always been able to just buck authority. He's always just been able to just say, well, I don't think that's the right thing to do, you know, or Norman Osborn is in charge now, so I'm not doing this anymore. And he just goes his own way. And he's not going to have the chance to do that here. That would be detrimental to everyone. He has a vested interest in maintaining this balance and keeping this peace between the tensions at Stark and Babbage in the military. So it's a story that very much spins out of Matt's Invincible Iron Man run, which is one of my favorite books out today.
Me too.
And, you know, it very much exists on that same street. You know, we worked very hard to make it feel like it's happening in the same world. Obviously, in the Marvel Universe, all books are interconnected and there's a shared continuity, but at the same time, I think we all recognize that there are a lot of different genres and tones and styles contained therein, and we really have been working hard to make this feel like if you're reading one, you can just pick the other right up, and they're not interconnected stories per se. But they are, but they do share a lot in common in terms of the way that they approach things.
Is there going to be a lot of Marvel military people beyond the Iron Man world that we'll see in this book?
Yeah. That's all I can really probably say.
No,
about
okay,
right now,
and that's why I kept it that kind of. Yeah, I want you to tell your story at your time. Don't get me wrong, but yeah, I just
You don't. You know, look, you don't. yeah, well, you know. It would be embarrassing if I got fired from the book before it came out.
You're through.
Right.
No. Don't worry, man.
But you know, look. I don't play in these universes unless I get to have fun with some of the toys. You know,
like, good for you.
It's. I don't like to just kind of go off and do my own thing. I want this to be a part of the Marvel universe and want it to be something that affects other stories and is affected by other stories. And yeah, that's a treat for me, man.
Well, and it sounds like you're going to get to explore the military kind of in the same way that Hickman has been able to explore Marvel's espionage world. Or
absolutely.
You know,
you look at what Matt's. To me, one of the most interesting things is, like, you've seen Matt's story has been very much from Tony's perspective, and usually Tony is narrating that story for us, and so you're getting Tony's side
sure.
of things all the time. And, you know, Tony has been, in the past, an arms manufacturer. He's been a weapons manufacturer, and that's you know, been a big part of his career. And, you know, that you're going to see things from the other side now, and you're going to see what it's like to be working in the Pentagon and, you know, having weapons manufacturers coming to you and the problems that causes. You know, let's be honest. This isn't true recently as much, but you know, there's been a long history of Iron Man stories where the military is pressuring Tony to release some kind of weapon so that they can use it in some very aggressive and oftentimes irresponsible manner.
Sure.
You know, and that's certainly a valid story. That's a great story to tell. But there are also stories about weapons manufacturers coming to the Pentagon and placing enormous pressure through political lobbies and other means to get them to buy things, because war is good for business. And you have stories of military men who are trying desperately not to over-engage and not incite, and yet there's always this pressure to buy to develop new weapons and to buy more bullets, because all of that moves the wheels of the economy. And so we're going to look at the other side of that fence, you know, and say, okay, we've been hearing a lot of stories about noble-minded weapons manufacturers. Now let's tell some stories about the guys that buy that stuff. So
very cool.
It's going to be fun to sort of get inside the Marvel Universe's Pentagon and take a look at how they work day to day.
Well, it sounds like you're playing in some pretty ambitious playgrounds, man. That's very cool. That's fun. Very good. This is the hope for, you know, superhero comics, that they go into different areas, and it's time to explore different backgrounds, and it shouldn't just be the superhero as detective or the superhero as investigator or just any of the, you
Absolutely.
Know, the typical tropes, and it sounds like you're, you know,
Look,
looking at different
I'm
backgrounds.
A great example of that, is, you know, all this great stuff that Matt's been doing in Stark Resilient. And, you know, I picked up my copy of Wired a couple weeks ago, right? And the cover is the CEO of Tesla Motors, and talking all about, you know, their efforts at building an electric car from the ground up. And you just look at that and you see the parallels, and you see, you know, how Matt's taken from real life stories. And, you know, you just it's exciting when you can see comics be that relevant. You know, and yeah, the same stuff with you look at what John's doing in S.H.I.E.L.D. and just that sort of long view of history, and, you know, and even, you know, a huge story about just, you know, the growth and development of mankind. And it's great to see that kind of stuff for me. I get so excited to pick those books up and tear through them. So to be able to kind of play in the same directions, that's really something I'm psyched about.
Good deal. And hopefully your books are all going to be $2.99. So,
I guess I mean.
Let's hope so. Don't get me wrong, and I no one's objecting at paying the $3.50 for Morning Glories, because I think
that's okay.
When you're self publishing, it's its own animal, and I think everyone forgives that.
We work really hard to give them extra pages.
In
Morning Glories too. So it, you know, we haven't done a 22 page issue of Morning Glories yet, and I kind of doubt that we ever will. So, it's obviously the game on the indie side is a little different, but, you know, we try to make it the best value that we can.
Well, excellent.
But sure. No, listen. I told the Marvel guys they should sell all my stuff for like 75 cents. You know, so don't look at me. All right, I was just, I don't know. I was like, guys, a dollar is pushing it. So.
Well, what about availability?
Yeah,
go ahead. What were you going to say?
You know what? Here's what I would tell everybody. You'll pay what they're worth. Let's.
I understand.
Just leave it right there. Yeah.
Well, then, and your previous books, Existence 2.0 and 3.0, and then Shuttertown. What are the trade plans for those?
Those are all supposed to be dropping here in like the next month or so.
Oh, terrific!
No. I think the Shuttertown hardcover comes out. What I don't know when this will come out, but the same Wednesday as Morning Glories 3. It should be on the 20th of October. So,
fantastic.
If that actually arrives in shops and everything, that's two down, and then we're just waiting on the Forgetless one, and I've gotten
Forgetless.
That, so, yeah.
Shame on me for forgetting Forgetless. All right, go on.
Oh, hey. It's my favorite finished work, so, I'm pretty stoked to see that one get out there as well, but yeah, they're all coming. They're all on their way, and then I think the Morning Glories collection is in February and collects 1 through 6, and it is an insane bargain because all of those issues have extra pages, and the first one is 44, and I think the fifth one is 32. So I mean, it's like 200 pages for $9.99.
Wow!
It's a stupid deal.
That's excellent, man. Well, there you go.
No, it worked for us with the single. It worked for us with number one. You know, we did double size for $3.99, and people really responded to that and gave the book a shot as a result. So we all just sat down as a team and said, you know, are we okay with deferring less money on this first one because we believe we're playing a long game, and hopefully it'll pay off.
That's great. Well, good luck with that, and I think the added benefit of the mainstream books that you're involved with as well are only going to help your image numbers continue. And good luck with the Infinite Vacation. That sounds like a great concept.
Yeah.
So that's great. No, nice going, Nick. I'm very happy for you, man. You've been a fellow Bendis board member for a long time, and I'm glad that your star has emerged, and the critical response to your works have been all positive, and I think people are very excited about what you're doing, and will continue to follow your work. So keep it up. And
I do want to put you on the spot for just a second.
By all means,
and tell you, I would not be, and I do not mean this to kiss your ass. I'm glad I got to say this at the end of things as opposed to the beginning, because it would sound like I was just sucking up. But I would not be writing comics if not for Word Balloon, and if not for the Bendis tapes in particular. I would, when I was, even before I was sending out pitches, when I was just writing scripts to throw them away and just trying to get better as a writer, I would sit and I would listen to those, and I would treat them like comic book college, and I would just take notes, and I would get excited, and I would feel like I had learned something, and when I would listen to them, I just couldn't wait to get back to writing. And it really kept me on task, and I fell back on a lot of that advice. I still use a lot of that stuff. So, you know, to come on here to get to do this and everything, it's a real honor for me, actually. It was something that I always kind of looked at and said, man, I can't wait to get my Word Balloon, you know, so.
Well, it's my pleasure.
That stuff had a huge impact on me and on my career.
Well, that's wonderful, man. I'm glad you were able to glean some information from that, and I do believe that we've covered some ground that I'm sure other writers will find valuable as well. So thank you for contributing to the conversation.
Definitely.
That's Nick Spencer. Today's episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. You'll find a wide selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, omnibus editions, all with discounts of well below the standard retail price. In fact, you get 38% off the cover price of most Marvel, DC, and Image books, and Dark Horse books, 42% off at InStockTrades.com. A couple great selections from Nick Spencer from his Image collections. The Shuttertown hardcover is available. The standard retail price is $19.99, but at InStockTrades.com, it's just $12.39. And you can get his breakout series of last summer, Existence, both 2.0 and 3.0, collected in one volume. The standard retail price, $14.99 at InStockTrades.com, $9.29. Check out all the details. They're waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Suntress saying thanks again for listening. Keep your eyes peeled because more Word Balloon episodes are coming up in November. A great month. We've had a great run all year long. The great run continues with good conversation. Check it out every week at WordBalloon.com, our website. Also, check out iFanboy, where our new episodes of Word Balloon post every week. Don't forget as well to subscribe to the iTunes feed. The Word Balloon app is available. It's just $2.99, available at the iTunes store. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com, or follow me on Twitter under johnwordballoon. Before we leave, I wanted to mention a couple shows coming up this weekend. Of course, there's the Mid-Ohio Con. Make sure you go out there and say hello to my buddy Art Baltazar in Columbus, Ohio. If you're in the area, he'll be signing along with several other friends like Sean McKeever. A lot of great people at the Mid-Ohio Con. Check it out. If you're in the Tucson area of Arizona, you may want to check out the Tucson Comic Con. It's a one-day free event, November 6th. Go to TucsonComic-Con.com for full details. It's at the Hotel Arizona, but among their guests, they're going to have John Layman, Shannon Denton, Jeff Marriott, and Tony Parker. So if you're out there, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. That's the Tucson Comic Con happening November 6th at the Hotel Arizona, and it's free. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.